Good morning and happy Sabbath, One Turner Church. It's great to be with you again, especially from my five-day holiday that a lot of people have been saying. It wasn't a holiday in Currumbong. It never is a holiday in Currumbong. We had all the pastors in Australia come together. 500 pastors. Did you know we have that many pastors in Australia? And we all came and we all didn't listen to meetings because we all wanted to talk to each other. So we had meetings going to the church and we had workshops and they were great, but you could always hear in the background this chatter of pastors just talking somewhere on the campus because we have it every 5 years and they just wanted to come together and to grow and to connect, and it was a really good time. So blessings from Currumbong, blessings from our convention, and it's always great to be back in hot Melbourne. Goodness. We all survived yesterday. 39 degrees, and we have one room in the house that has aircon, and so we just kind of all huddled around there for the day. But it's nice to preach in a suit the day after. That is a Melbourne weather, isn't it? Coming back, and what is it, a high of 24 today, so it's nice to be able to preach like this today. Look, I want to welcome you. I want to welcome those who are joining us online as well, and today we have a sermon that's based on my daughter called It's Not Fair. I was trying to figure out what to preach for us this week, and my daughter actually came up with this one. So let's bow our heads as we invite the Lord in prayer and go into this sermon for today. Father in heaven, we just want to thank you so much for the time that we can spend together on your holy Sabbath. We want to thank you so much that we can come together and we can just not only talk to each other and be encouraged for the week ahead, but also hopefully hear a word straight from your word, Lord. And so I pray that today will be that time. We'll be able to learn more about you, is always my prayer in your precious name. Amen. Now, when I started theology at Avondale, they always used to drill something into our minds. And they said this, if you can tell a good story, then you're going to be a good preacher. And they actually, we had a class called homiletics. And if you know what homiletics means, it's basically how to preach. And before they even get us up the front to do the preaching from the pulpit, they actually get us to do a children's story at the local churches. Now, why do you think that's the case? Because if you can master a children's story, then you can preach very well, apparently. So, Heather, you did a great children's story. Next week, you're preaching. You can see the teacher coming out in her when she does that story. It was brilliant. And so this idea of stories kind of encapsulates what a good message is. If you can think about all of the good sermons in the past, whether it's from your favorite pastors, you could probably remember a story or two that they would have shared. So today, I want to be able to share with you the greatest story ever told. Now that's a really high bar, isn't it? Let me show you something. Jesus really talked in stories. You probably heard the word parable. And Jesus actually spoke about 33% of his teachings in a story. So about a third of his teachings were done in a particular story. And they weren't all true, per se, but they all had a symbolic meaning behind it. Now, this story that we're going to be talking about is a parable. Bit of a different sermon than we're used to. I'm going to be really focusing in on one parable today, which is apparently the best story that's ever been told by Jesus. Can I get some guesses as to what story you think that is? Because there are a lot of stories out there. Can anyone have a guess? Sorry? The Good Samaritan? That's a good story, but that's not it. The Prodigal Son, you guys are good. Now, you may have heard these authors before. You probably can't even read that. It's very small. Basically, you've heard of Dickens, Emerson, or Twain. Have you ever heard of those authors before? They all claim that this was the best story that has ever been told in the history of mankind. A really big claim. And yes, we heard it's the Prodigal Son. But while you're actually thinking about the story of the Prodigal Son, because I think most of us know the story almost off by heart, there's going to be a lot more to that story, hopefully, that we can kind of unpack today. So as you're thinking about that, I want to transport you into another world for about 5 minutes. So please, come with me as we go to one of the most fanciest restaurants that you've ever been to in your life. Right? I just want you to imagine, where's the fanciest place that you have been in your life in terms of a restaurant? Was it a few days ago for Valentine's Day? Anyone? No? Yeah, there's a few fancy restaurants that we've been to in the past, and I immediately go to the one in Brisbane where I took my wife before we were engaged. And I want you to sit down in table number 5. All right, you're in table number 5, you're with your significant other, and you look around the room, and there are many other tables. They're all chatting, they're all getting on with their lives. I just want you to imagine that for a minute. Now, while you're at table 5, you hear this commotion on table 18, just on the other side of the room, and a tall, blonde-haired woman is starting to shout at this man who's on the other side of the table. And you can hear that it is starting to get really heated. Suddenly, you can see that she stands up, she grabs her bottle of wine, and she throws the wine at the man, and his white shirt is all stained. And she goes off, storms out of the restaurant, she's done. And there's this man sitting there with a stain on his shirt. Now, I want you just to think about all of the conclusions you think have happened. What are some of the scenarios that are going through your mind as to what on earth had happened at table 18? Hold that thought as we go around the room to table 7. Table 7, there is a woman called Sabrina, and she is a strong, independent, assertive young woman. And she turns around and she looks at this table and she goes, why on earth did she not throw the bottle at him too? Why just the wine? Why didn't she just go halfway? Why didn't she go full at him? Because obviously he did something really bad. We can all see that. See, Sabrina was brought up always short in her class and was always bullied by all the boys in her class. And it maybe is no surprise that she grew up wanting to be the strongest and the toughest wherever she was. Now, on table 11, there's a couple called Marge and Bob. Marge and Bob have been married for 50 years. Anyone here been married more than 50 years? You're not even 50. Daryl, well, this is not about you, but this is a marriage that has lasted as long as yours. Marge and Bob have been sitting there, and suddenly they hear the commotion, and Marge turns around 180 degrees because she desperately wants to see what's going on. There's drama happening, and she doesn't get to see much drama in her life. She doesn't care what it is. She just wants to see something happening because she just goes through day to day, same thing over and over again, and she wants to see what this commotion is about. She couldn't care less what it was. She just wants to be a part of the drama. Bob, on the other hand, is still eating his spaghetti. He couldn't care less. He just wants to eat his food before he's told to leave, and to leave a plate of food on that table would be the worst thing for him. Then we get to table 2. His name is John, and he's a rich young accountant. And he looks at the wine that has been thrown on the man and goes, what a waste of money that was. He could see the wine and see that it was particularly expensive. And he thought, what a waste. We go back to table 18. There's a man sitting there. He's just had wine thrown on his shirt. And I hope I've given you some time to come up with your own conclusions as to what has gone on over there in table 18. Let me give you a bit of a rundown. His name is Deepak, and he is from Saudi Arabia. And he was sitting with his very early on fiancé. They were both Muslim. And he came back from a Christian convention and was telling his fiancé that he wants to give his life to Jesus. Did anyone ever guess that one? No. See, we all come up with different conclusions, but we've all seen the same thing. You've got this restaurant where table 18, the same thing happened, and you have all of these different people with all of their experiences and their baggage and their life, and they come in with this lens to try and interpret what they see, and we all do it. I could preach a sermon today and everyone could walk out with a different opinion of what has just gone on. And that's a good thing. But when we read a parable like the prodigal son, I actually want that to happen today. I don't want all of us to walk out of this room with the same conclusion. That's why this sermon is going to be a little bit of a different message today. And so, with that said, let us jump in to the prodigal son. But I want you to notice something. Is it just one story? No, it's three. I invite you to open your Bibles to Luke chapter 15 because I want you to notice something. We're going to be going through this almost text by text. And I want you to notice that the story that has been told is not just the lost boy. It's not just the prodigal son. It's actually in a series. It's a trilogy. Now, I don't know about you, but have you ever seen a good trilogy movie before? Yeah, well, you probably know a few good ones. My favorite is Lord of the Rings, right, for many different reasons. But if you just picked up the last movie of The Lord of the Rings, trying to understand the whole story behind it, guess what? You're not going to understand it at all. You're going to see a bunch of little men trying to climb a volcano, throwing a ring into lava. And you figure out, what on earth is going on? What is the implications behind the story? It's not until you start at the beginning and you realize the context of why they're going on that journey. The same thing applies to the lost series. And the thing with this story is it has two sides to the coin, which is why it's so exciting to share with you. So let's go through Luke 15 together. We're going to look at the first two verses, and I'm so sorry that it's very hard to see on that screen. I've chosen very small font for some reason. Luke 15 verses 1 to 2 will set the scene. And it says this: Then all the tax collectors and the sinners drew near to him to hear him. And the Pharisees and scribes complained, saying, This man receives sinners and eats with them. All right, we have the scene painted. There are four different characters that we can see. Number one, tax collectors. Now, we've all been told how bad the tax collectors were, but maybe you don't really understand how hated they were in the Jewish society. I like to call them the thugs or the mafia of the Jewish world. And this is why. If you had to give your tax and you would line up in the tax collector's booth, you would see on the sides of that booth two Roman soldiers. And if you didn't have enough money, you'd usually get a beating. And you would also probably have more money added on to the loan that you have now. In other words, you were caught up in a very vicious interest loan that you may not be able to pay for the rest of your life. The worst part about this is that the tax collector is one of your own. They're Jews just like you. That's why I like to call them the thugs or the mafia of the Jewish world. The second type of people we see are the sinners or the outcast. So we see a group of these people who they could be the lepers. They could be the ones who have been sent out for some reason. They don't belong in any circle. And they are here present as well. Have you ever felt outcast before? Have you ever felt like you've been in a group that you just don't belong in? Can you remember that feeling? I don't know about you, but the worst decision that I've ever made in my life is when we were going to see an All Blacks Wallabies game at the ANZ Stadium in Sydney. And I gave my ticket, well, I left my ticket to be bought by my mates, who are all Wallabies supporters. And so we arrive at the station, and then we get over to the stadium, and we walk past the general admission part where everyone sits, right? That's the cheapest ticket. That's where everyone goes and sits together. They all mingle. No, we start to walk all the way to the end of the stadium where you see all of this green and gold. And guess what I'm wearing? Black and white. And so we walk towards the supporters' bay of the Wallabies in the middle of an All Blacks Wallabies game. And I wish I had the picture here because I do have it at home. There's a zoomed out picture of the stadium and you can see this black dot in the middle of a yellow and gold sea of people. And that was probably the scariest time I've ever had in my life because the All Blacks won and I had to get home on the train station, and all my mates, they said it was a prank, and you know, I laughed after I got home, after I was safe. But being in a place where you don't belong and scared, it's a scary feeling. It's a very unpleasant feeling. These guys were feeling it all the time. Who's the third character? The Pharisees, of course. The Pharisees, we all know, are the religious leaders of the Jewish world. One thing that I didn't realize about these guys, if they need even more of a bad reputation, is a pastor called John MacArthur. And he actually says that Pharisees used to have two shifts of cleaning people to clean their house because they believed that if the house was to be stopped being cleaned, then it will become unclean. And it would become unclean physically and spiritually at the same time. And so they always had to have someone come over to clean the parts of the house to make sure that they were clean and okay, ready for God. And it kind of tells you where the Pharisees were in terms of works, but we won't get into that. And then, of course, the last and most important character of the group, Jesus Christ. Now, to Christ's credit, not many stories do you have all four of these people together in one place. Do you notice that? The tax collectors, the sinners, the Pharisees, and Jesus. You don't see that very often in the Bible. But you'll notice in verse 2, this kind of creates the question or the problem of the story. It said, "And the Pharisees and scribes complained, saying, 'This man receives sinners and eats with them.'" Now, why on earth are the Pharisees calling Jesus out for this? If you want, you don't have to do it now, but later on, check chapter 14, which is the previous chapter, and you'll notice the first two verses, Jesus is eating with the Pharisees in their home, and they've actually brought him in and are eating with him. Now, if you, in that culture, are eating with someone, that means they have accepted you in their home and they have accepted you as a person. They think you're one of them. Hospitality is a very important thing in that culture. And so when just one chapter before he's eating with the Pharisees and then now he's eating with the sinners and the tax collectors, the Pharisees were not happy. You could almost see them, and this is where the title of the sermon comes from, saying to Jesus, "That's not fair. That's not right. You can't go and have dinner with the Pharisees and then go and have dinner with the sinners and the outcasts. That's not how things work around here. Jesus, you're breaking the rules. It is not fair." Have you seen this before? Anyone here had kids? I can see. There are a few parents around here. Have you heard your child say it's not fair before? How early do they pick up that sentence? The moment they can speak, right? Yeah. The reason why this was inspired by my daughter is because for some reason lately, every time she does something wrong and she's with Lucas, so for example, I'll be lying on the couch and they'll both jump onto me and I say, "Stop." I say, "Stop doing that, Naomi." And she goes, "Tell Lucas off too." And I go, "Why am I telling Lucas? He's 1 year old. He doesn't understand it. Tell him off as well." So I'll say, "Lucas, stop jumping on me." And he jumps on me again, right? It doesn't do anything. But Naomi is happy that I've told him off, even though it doesn't make any shred of difference. Why? Because now it's fair. And she is so young, and she has picked up this kind of fairness. And if you are a parent of more than one child, you'll know the struggle of the favorite toy, or who gets to sit in the front seat, or who gets the favorite part of wherever it is. You have to be equal, or some things happen later in life that don't go according to plan. And so the Pharisees, almost kind of like this baby, is going, "Hang on, that's not fair. You chose us. I thought you were one of us. And now you're going off to the sinners and the outcasts and the tax collectors." This is the question that Jesus is addressing before he gets into the trilogy of the Lost series. So, church family, let's go through it very quickly. The first two stories, you probably know what they are, and I'll read them from verse 4 to 7, and then we'll look at the next one. So this is the lost sheep. "What man of you, having 100 sheep, if he loses one of them, does not leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after one which is lost until he finds it? And when he has found it, he lays it on the shoulders, rejoicing. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and neighbors, saying to them, 'Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep which was lost.' I say to you that likewise there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 just persons who need no repentance." I want you to notice a pattern here. Number one, there was something lost. Number two, there was something found. And number three, there was a celebration. Easy, simple. That's the formula, right? Let's go on to the next one. verses 8 to 10. Or what woman, having 10 silver coins, if she loses one coin, does not light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it? And when she has found it, she calls her friends and neighbors together, saying, "Rejoice with me, for I have found the piece that I lost." Likewise, I say to you, there is joy in the presence of angels of God over one sinner who repents. Notice exactly the same thing here. Something is lost, something is found, and there's a celebration. Now, I want you just to kind of step back and see. Imagine the Pharisees at this point, because remember, they're part of the crowd listening to the story, right? And they hear these two first stories, and they could probably nod their head going, "Yes, Jesus, we totally understand. There's one sheep out of 100. Yep, go find it. There's one coin out of 10. Yep, go find it." Everyone is in agreement. And then suddenly, and I love Jesus here, it's like he's setting them up for almost a trap, but Jesus doesn't do that. He's kind of setting them up for a false sense of security, because you've got this kind of next story, which is the one that we talk about, the lost son or the prodigal son. Now, I'm going to go through this pretty quickly because hopefully you guys know the story quite well, but we're going to go through it almost step by step. Number one, verse 11 and 12. Then he said, "A certain man had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the portion of goods that fall to me.' So he divided to him his livelihood." To be asked for your inheritance in that culture was to be kicked out of your home and no longer be regarded as a son. Because not only was the dad having to go, there's no bank. You can't go to the bank and grab one half or one third of the inheritance. You had to sell a piece of your land. You had to sell whatever was contributing to what you were doing. And they had to go and to give that portion to the son. And the biggest part here is that the father gives in and actually says, sure. That was not only a huge disrespect to the father, but the father returned the favor, and so both were at fault. Now, immediately the Pharisees would have probably cringed at this part of the story, saying, hang on, that shouldn't happen. A son should never ask his father for his inheritance, and the father should never give in. So number one, we have a very weird introduction to the third story. Number two, verse 13, "And not many days after, the younger son gathered all together, journeyed to a far country, and there wasted his possessions with prodigal living," hence the name the prodigal son. To leave your country was symbolically meaning that you leave everything that you believe. So not only was the son disrespecting the father, but the son was also saying, "I'm leaving everything that you've brought me up to be." Now, this is almost the same story as most teenagers that go through life today. I did it. I left my home at 17. I ran away and I said, "I don't want to do anything to do with what you guys have brought me up to do, because I want to learn my own life. I want to go and do that." Now, I had the extra part that my dad died when I was 17, so my whole world just crashed before me. But I can kind of understand the son here as he's running away, trying to understand life in a different lens. And maybe you have kids, or maybe you're going through this yourself, where you just want to rebel against what is going on. Next one, verse 14. "But when he had spent it all, there arose a severe famine in that land, and he began to be in want." I don't want to go too much into detail, but when you hear a parable symbolically talking about a land going barren, in the Bible, that actually represents some form of curse that has been placed upon you. God is not happy. In Psalm 107, verse 34, it says, "A fruitful land into a salty waste because of the evil of its inhabitants." Remember, this is a symbolic story. Next part, rock bottom. Maybe some of us will kind of understand this part of the story. Verse 15 to 16, "Then he went and joined himself to a citizen of that country, and he sent him into the fields to feed swine. And he would gladly have filled his stomach with the pods that the swine ate, and no one gave him anything." Church family, let me ask you a really quick question. What is the rock bottom for a Jewish person? What's rock bottom? Pigs. Why are pigs rock bottom? Because they're unclean, right? But it's not even that he's hanging out with the pigs. He's eating the food that were given to the pigs. There is probably no worse off curse that a Jewish person could have but to be sleeping with pigs and eating its food. You basically found rock bottom for the Jews. There's nothing better to explain here than this section. But thankfully, the story doesn't end there. We have it going up. In verse 17 to 19, "But when he came to himself, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have bread enough to spare? And I perish with hunger. I will arise and go to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.'" One of the good things about reaching rock bottom is you can only go up. And the thing with the son is that his pride was put aside and he said, maybe even the worst place in my father's house was better than where I am right now. Now, I know of a lot of parents in churches across Australia that hope that their child who has left the church has this type of experience. That maybe somewhere in their journey outside of God and the church that they'll realize that they had it good when they were young. And that maybe sometime they'll come back. This is a story for many people right now. But we see the son and he goes back and he wants to be a part of this lesser part of his father's household. And we know the story. In verse 20, "And he arose and came to his father, but when he was still a great way off," this one gets me, "his father saw him and had compassion and ran." He ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. Remember, the son had only just previously disrespected his father. But the moment he saw his son come back, he could only run and cry and embrace him. And again, if you put yourself in a Pharisaical Jewish mind, that is a no-no. You never run if you're a distinguished man. You always walk. The Pharisees probably were a bit angry at this point. There's a lot of parts of the story that would make them angry. Last part, 21. "And the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight, and am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, bring out the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet, and bring the fatted calf here and kill it, and let us eat and be merry. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they began to be merry." Now we know this story, and we all know that it doesn't end with, "and they live happily ever after, and they had many kids," and the story ends, right? Would that be a good story if it ended here, right now? Would that be a nice little story? It would be kind of like one of those Christmas movies that you watch, right? Where everything goes crazy, and then at the end, all the family comes together, and they all live happily ever after. Right? That would be a nice story if it stopped there. But you have to remember that these stories were in response to a question or a statement. The Pharisees saying, "What on earth are you doing with these sinners and these rejects and these tax collectors? Why are you over there with them when you were with us before? It's not fair." Jesus is trying to answer something. And so when you see this, I just want you to notice from a mathematical point of view, right? We've had the first story, which is you lose 1 out of 100. Pharisees, sure, great idea, go get it. 1 out of 10, sure, go get it, let's have a celebration. But Jesus follows up with a third story that's 1 out of 2 people. He comes back, something was lost, something was found, and there's a celebration, and the Pharisees do not want anything to do with this last story. Why on earth is the lost son following the same pattern as the other two stories and yet has a different response than the first two stories? Well, enter the older brother. And the older brother changes everything. Let me read the verses for you, and maybe you can see what happens. Verse 25, "Now his older son was in the field, and as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing." what on earth is going on? Why is there so much happiness in this place? So he called one of the servants and asked them what these things meant. And he said to him, your brother has come, and because he has received him safe and sound, your father has killed the fatted calf. But he was angry and would not go in. Therefore his father came out and pleaded with him. So he answered and said to his father, lo, these many years I have been serving you. I have never transgressed your commandment at any time, and yet you never gave me a young goat that I might make merry with my friends. But as soon as the son of yours came, who has devoured your livelihood with harlots, you killed the fatted calf for him. Now, I don't know about you, but can some of you guys relate to what the older son's going through? If you've ever been in a family of siblings, and let's say one of the siblings who has been always the naughty child, right? There's always a kind of a good, mature one, and then there's the one that's always naughty. It's usually the younger one that kind of plays up. And let's say that the younger one goes off, does his thing, disrespects the family, comes back, and you, being the responsible child, being right by the side of your parents, suddenly the whole family goes crazy for this younger child coming back because he's come back to the household. He hasn't done anything to ask for forgiveness. He hasn't done anything to repay his sins. He's just come back and suddenly the whole household is celebrating. I can imagine myself as being the older son and being super unhappy myself. He does everything right. He never leaves the father. He's been an Adventist all his life. He's gone to church every Sabbath. He's never had a young goat, but you gave him the fatted calf. That's not fair. And I don't know about you, but I can definitely feel myself being the older brother. So how do we reconcile this? And what's the purpose of the older brother coming in to the picture? Let me show you the two sides of the coin. The younger brother represents the sinners. He's hit rock bottom. He has a repentant heart. His father forgives him. And it's meant for that group who's listening, the tax collectors, the sinners, the outcasts. But the other side of the story is the older brother, who says that he's done everything right. He's good, but he has a prideful heart. And the father is still understanding towards the brother, but you can kind of see how this was meant for the Pharisees. See, one of the reasons why this is such a great story and one of the greatest stories of all time is because Jesus, at the same time, can talk to two completely different groups of people and bring a different message to that person. And you look at the father's response to the older brother. He says, and he said to him, son, you are always with me, and in all of what I have is yours. It was right that we should make merry and be glad, for your brother was dead and is alive again, and was lost and is found. Both brothers have their struggles. In both instances, the father still loves his kids, but they both had a different lesson to learn. Let me ask you a question. What group or what brother do you kind of connect with the most? Do you connect most with the younger brother who goes off, wants nothing to do with God, and wants to find his way back home? Or do you find yourself in the place with the older brother who's been in church all his life, done the right thing all the time? And maybe you struggle with some of the grace that God maybe gives to those who have fallen away. I'll give you an example of God's grace in all of this. And this is a hard one for me to swallow sometimes. Adolf Hitler may be in heaven. Let me say that again. Adolf Hitler may be in heaven. Now, how does that statement make you feel? Are you uncomfortable or are you happy? Because the response that you give tells you what side of the coin you are and how you actually see the story of grace. No one in this world is too far away from God's love. Everyone who repents, those who give themselves to God, no matter what your past is, can find grace in God's calling. The reason why I use Adolf Hitler is because he is regarded as the most evil person who has ever lived on this earth, for good reason. He's killed many, many people. But here's the thing. We don't know what he was doing in his last moments. We don't even know whether he flew to, I don't want to get to conspiracy theories, Argentina, or whatever it was, and gave his life to Christ and spent the last 10 years of his life doing good things. We have no idea. But the fact that Jesus could extend his grace to someone like him, and some of us may feel angry about it, puts us in the older brother category. Because we are looking at someone who, in our mind, has done so bad of a job in his life that he has no chance of coming to heaven. The judgment is already placed on him. He can't come in. He's done too bad of a job. That's the older brother. Looking at a scenario and placing judgment and saying, you do not belong here. Let me make it closer to home in the Bible. Does everyone know the story of Stephen when he was stoned? Can you imagine the connection in heaven when he sees Saul? Or how do we know him as? Paul. The last thing that Stephen knew in his life was that he stood up for God and he was stoned by a Pharisee. That man, Saul, was standing there holding the coats of the Pharisees and of the people as they were stoning him as he was dying on the ground. And yet, can you imagine the conversation we get in heaven just to catch Stephen up just a little bit, just to let him know that Saul has kind of changed just a tad. He kind of wrote maybe half of the New Testament, and he actually wasn't that bad of a person eventually. Why? Because God's grace was extended upon him. Paul, or Saul, was the younger child who ran off and did his own thing but came back to God and said, I am the worst sinner of all. I'm the worst of them. And he spent his whole life trying to give back to God for what are the things that he did in his life that were wrong. So my question for you is, where do you lie and what perception, what takeaway do you get from the story of the Lost series? Because everyone here, I guarantee, will walk out of this church with a different understanding of what was shared today. And that's not a bad thing. But let me answer the last question that the Pharisees asked Jesus. They basically said, it's not fair. And let me just answer what Jesus had said. He said, yes, it isn't fair because God's grace is not fair. There will be people who at the end of their lives will give their life to Christ and Jesus will say, you are welcome here. And there will be people who have been a churchgoer all their life and have completely missed the mark. And so I'm here to ask you, what side of the coin are you in? Because no matter where you are on that side, we all need Christ and his grace. We all need his love. We all need something to bring us closer to him. God's grace is not fair, but that, church family, is a good thing.